In this session, we examine the role of the law in supporting business. In the common law systems, such as in the United States and in England, this branch of the law is called fiduciary law, as distinguished from contract law. We will include in this branch of the law the statutes that regulate financial and business institutions and the financial markets. In civil law countries such as France and Germany, many of the principles of fiduciary law are included in the contract law. But there are some fundamental differences between the two systems, and we will discuss them later. The principles in both systems go back to Roman law that imposed duties on trusted persons. We start with an examination of the nature of fiduciary duties, and then proceed to analyze the reasons for their importance to establishing trusting relationships. It should be clear from the outset that the parties, not the law, decide whether to deal and what kind of deal to make. Parties are free to engage in business or not to engage. They are free to choose their business partners. They are free to decide the terms of the agreements they make, so long as these are legal. What the parties cannot decide, in most cases at least, is the category of the law to which their deal belongs, whether it's a contract or agency or trust, for example. The classification of the relationship is the business of the courts or the legislature or other government agencies. For example, suppose Abel gives Baker $100,000 and says to him, "I'm ill and I'm going to die. My children are still small. Please invest this money well for them and give them what they need until they grow up, and then hand them to the whatever is left." Baker promises Abel to take care of the children and the money, and both sign an agreement, and they call it contract. Under the common law, this arrangement is a trust. Another book of rules applies to this deal. If it were a contract, Baker could borrow the money or deal with it as he pleased, so long as he complies with the directives in the contract. If the arrangement is a trust, Baker may not borrow the money, and numerous other prohibitions apply to him, even if nothing was said in the trust instrument. Most rules of fiduciary law are what we call default rules. That means rules that apply automatically, unless the beneficiaries agree to relieve the fiduciaries from the prohibitions in these rules. For example, beneficiaries may agree that their trustee will borrow trust funds, provided, of course, that the beneficiaries are of age and have the capacity to agree. Some argue that these default rules are rules which the parties themselves would have set for the transaction had they simply thought of it. Some believe that the courts factor in not only what the parties would have agreed, but also how default rules protect the system as a whole. Courts may use fiduciary law to entice people to take risks of trusting. Courts may be paternalistic, or courts may believe that if people agree to waive certain protections that trust law provides, they do not know or do not understand what they are doing. In such cases, the courts will not approve the parties' agreement and enforce fiduciary rules nonetheless. We note that the regulation of institutions and of the financial markets, like the securities markets, for example, are stricter in this sense. Many rules regulating the securities markets and the banks, that's another example, are mandatory, and the parties cannot contract around them. A seller and a buyer of stock and their broker may not agree that the Securities Act will not apply to them. This prohibition seems to be based on the concern for the integrity of the financial system and the policy of ensuring public trust in that system. In law, there are many types of fiduciaries. you have agents and partners, corporate directors and officers and money managers and advisors and trustees. The relationships have a family resemblance, but they are different. The rules that apply to them are not the same. Fiduciaries have this in common. They all pose risks to trusting parties. The differences between the types of fiduciaries reflect the differences in these risks. Fiduciary duties are designed to reduce these risks. The more risky it is to trust in a type of fiduciary relationship, the stricter the rules governing the fiduciary are going to be. When do fiduciary duties arise? The first thing we notice is that all members of the fiduciary family provide services and that these services are usually supported by public policy. For example, public policy supports the use of agents. You can do so much more if you use agents for some activities. In historic Rome, slaves who could not be parties to a contract themselves, personally, were allowed to be agents for their masters. They could bind the masters to legal obligations, to buy and to sell, even when they themselves could not do it. We maintain agency system for the same reason, although the circumstances have changed. We define agents as people to whom we give the power to bind us to legal obligations. Notice that the agents are not a party. They are transparent. We, the principals, are the parties. Like agency, public policy supports money managers, management services, management of corporations, lawyer services. These are services that require trust and pose various degrees of risk for the trusting parties. A number of factors make particular services risky. First, unlike the purchase of the newspaper that we described a long time ago, when I empower an agent to bind me to a legal obligation, I must give him the power first. If I appoint a trustee for my children, the trustee gets possession and title of the trust property first. If we elect directors, they get their power first before they begin to manage. Only after these powers and properties are transferred will I find out whether the agent performed his duties well or the trustees fulfilled his promises competently and honestly, or whether the corporate directors managed the corporation with attention and honesty. So this is number one. Second, the power or property that fiduciary receives is given to him for one purpose only. That's to enable the fiduciary to perform his obligations more effectively. It is not a sale. It's not an exchange. So I give my money to a trustee to manage for my children. I ask a lawyer to represent me in court, or write for me a will, or organize for me a corporation, and give him power to bind me to legal obligations. The purpose is to enable all these fiduciaries to provide me the service in a more effective way. Therefore, the beneficiary, and just the beneficiary and no one else, not the fiduciary and not third party, should benefit from the power of property that was transferred. That is, unless the beneficiary so orders. Third, it is costly for beneficiaries to monitor and evaluate whether the fiduciaries perform their services competently. The services require expertise. If the beneficiary wishes to evaluate the competence of a lawyer, he has to study law. If he does that, there's little value in the lawyer's services for him. Beneficiaries of these types of services cannot judge competence and honesty by the results. A brilliant lawyer may lose the case because of the facts. A faulty will may be invalidated only after the client dies, years later. Fourth, it is costly for the beneficiaries to monitor the fiduciary's honesty. Once the power property have been transferred, it is difficult to determine whether the fiduciary abused this power, used it for any other purpose. Fifth, although as we have studied, markets and external monitors help reduce the risk from trusting, markets rarely discover the problems before they occur. For example, markets rarely discover, let alone prevent, mismanagement by a money manager before the fact. If we wish to entice investors to take the risk of trusting and hand their money over to managers, protection must come before, not after mismanagement. The risk is too great. Investors will simply not hand over their money to trustees unless they are sure it is safe. One last element must be added to the list. The cost for fiduciaries in convincing beneficiaries of their trustworthiness can be very high. Fiduciaries can provide guarantees and other proof of their trustworthiness, but if the risk for the beneficiaries is high, and if the cost to the fiduciary to establish the trustworthiness is high, the parties will simply not interact. I believe that it is at this juncture that you can expect the law to bridge the gap. When external monitoring and other private sector controls of abuse increase, for example, more self-regulation appears, the law will retreat. But when external monitoring decreases, the law and its enforcement agents, such as the courts, will fill the vacuum. Here's an example of a role of the law. Assume that Abel hands Baker $100,000 for management. Assume that Baker expects additional income from, Abel expects additional income from Baker's expert management of 4%, let's say $4,000. Assume further that Baker charges for management 1%, $1,000. So Abel expects net return of $3,000. But if Abel believes that the risk of embezzlement and mismanagement to which he is exposed is 25%, he will stand to lose $25,000. On these assumptions, Abel will not enter into the transaction unless the potential loss from mismanagement is smaller than his potential gain, that is $3,000. Now look at Baker. Baker, the money manager, will not spend more than $1,000 on establishing his trustworthiness. In fact, he will spend less, since he must earn something for his efforts and pay the rent as well. So it is this kind of gap that the law will bridge in order to entice the beneficiaries to enter into the relationship. The law of private trust is strict, and the trustees are supervised by the courts. That is because the beneficiaries do not choose the trustee, the trustor, who leaves the scene after establishing the trust. He has made the choice. Beneficiaries can rarely remove the trustee. They have no control over his decision. The court does, and the trust instrument. Now compare it with agency. In agency, the agent is chosen by the principal and is controlled by the principal. He can be removed by the principal. Therefore, the rules of agency are less strict than those of trust. Now look at corporate directors. They are chosen, they are elected by the shareholders. But during their tenure, directors like trustees are not subject to the control of the shareholders, and their removal is very difficult. What you find then is that the law attempts to adjust their in-between status and create the appropriate controls for them. Where the financial system is concerned, we find greater government supervision. Government agencies will do what the investors would have done, examine the fiduciaries, protect the money entrusted to them from mismanagement and from theft. The cost of trust in the system integrity is covered by the taxpayer, the industry, and sometimes by investors. It is divided, it is spread out. For example, to prevent runs on banks, the FDIC in the United States, a government corporation, guarantees up to $100,000 per account. You notice that the guarantee covers poor and rich people alike, whether they agree with the guarantee or they don't agree with the guarantee. Neither the banks nor the depositors can change the terms of the guarantee. That is because there is a concern for the system. You may say, we do not know. Perhaps the risk to the system is not so great. Perhaps you should give fiduciaries and beneficiaries the right to decide for themselves how much protection they want and how much they're willing to pay for it. Well, in theory, it's worth a try. But in practice, it seems that the risk to the system may be too high. If we ask people who have bank accounts or investments, especially their life savings, whether they would like to try a system with fewer controls, what do you think the answer is going to be? I think they will probably say better not. Stricter rules can be preventive rules that preclude situations which are not themselves violations, but which may lead to a breach of the required behavior. For example, in trust law, the rule is that the trustee must separate his private funds from the trust funds. One purpose of this rule is to make sure that the creditors of the trustee will not give the trustee credit on the basis of the trust funds that seem to belong to the trustee. But the other purpose, I believe, is psychological. It is to prevent the trustee from looking at trust funds as his own. When he looks at the funds, they tell him, do not even think about borrowing a few dollars and returning them after the holidays. Are not yours. Another rule requires the trustee to earmark trust property. The purpose of this rule is to prevent the trustee from buying stocks, for example, and if the price goes up later, taking the stock for his own, and if the price goes down later, dumping the stock on the trust fund at the original price. The gain then belongs to the trustee, the loss then belongs to the trust. Now, the main prohibition is really on trustees benefiting from trust assets or on dumping the trustees' losses on the beneficiaries. But the rules go further. They provide a procedure that prevents these results. A trustee may not keep stocks that are not earmarked. If he does, the stocks are his. So the earmarking prevents the trustee from violating the main duty. Another example is a rule in corporate law that directors or officers of a corporation may not engage in a business that is competing with a corporation's business. The assumption is that the directors will favor themselves as compared to the corporation. That assumption becomes now absolute. We do not ask whether, in fact, they did defer or did something to the detriment of the corporation. The prohibition to compete is the rule. Now look at another rule. Directors, like other fiduciaries, may not deal with the corporation. For example, sell to the corporation stocks that they own. Here, a somewhat different rule applies. Although the same assumption would suggest that the directors should favor their own interests, for example, charge a higher than market price. And it is recognized, however, that they will benefit the corporation. For example, there would be no expense or commission. So here, the transaction may also benefit the corporation. And therefore, the rule is still that directors may not deal with the corporation. But if the corporation has an independent group of directors, and the majority of those directors decides that the deal is to the best interest of the corporation and the shareholders, then the deal may be sanctioned. Now I'll give you the last example. In mutual funds, the rule is different. Under the Investment Company Act of 1940, directors, among other affiliates, may not sell to the funds or buy from the funds or borrow from the funds. And the prohibition is unconditional. The only body that may allow such a transaction is the government, the Securities and Exchange Commission. And it does so by exempting the transaction from the prohibition. And the exemption process requires an application, a publication in the Federal Register, opportunity for those who have standing to object, a possible hearing at the discretion of the commission. So the commission throughout the years has passed rules exempting certain transactions from the prohibition, but the parties cannot agree to eliminate the prohibition. Both contract and fiduciary laws, as well as other laws, require the parties to tell the truth and keep their promises. You would say that all these rules encourage trusting among people. The differences between these sets of rules is in how they are implemented and by whom. These differences are crucial. They also result in different models of trusting relationships. In the United States, contract is suitable to situations in which the buyer can ask the questions that interest him, and then the seller will have to answer truthfully. But the buyer does not expect the shopkeeper to inform him that the shop across the street is selling the same item at a discount. The buyer understands that he has to do the shopping by himself. But when it comes to a lawyer, what question would we ask a lawyer to establish that he has prepared the case well or drafted the agreement correctly? What question would we ask the astronaut or the engineers who design the spacecraft? Here we find a need to require the fiduciaries to give the answers even if they are not asked. So in contrast, the posture is, do not trust me and do not rely on me. Take care of yourself. I will take care of myself. But in fiduciary relationships, trust your fiduciary. He will act for your benefit and in your interest. In addition to providing many more default rules than contract law does, fiduciary law provides beneficiaries with property law remedies. The common law recognizes a split in property rights, vesting in trustees and other fiduciaries the title to those rights, but leaving the beneficiaries with the beneficial ownership rights. This is a fundamental difference and distinction between the common law and the civil law system. In civil law, based on German and French codes and transported also to other countries, the trust relationships are always contract. Contract in these countries imposes many duties, as we said, to disclose and to be fair. But the money that I give an investment advisor to manage would become the advisor's property. He is the only subject to obligations. I cannot demand the property as mine. In theory, the split of ownership may bring confusion to property legal schemes. However, this theoretical difference has practical results when a trustee or other fiduciary becomes bankrupt. The creditors of the fiduciary can then claim the trust funds, and the beneficiaries may have to stand in line as creditors, either secured or unsecured. In addition, under the common law, the rights of the contract party are far less protected than the rights of the contract party under civil law. Understanding the difference between common law and civil law is important as capital markets and financial management become global. The common law trust and concept of fiduciary do not always gain recognition in civil law countries, but they are increasingly dealing with this trust creature. There is a proposed treaty that would recognize the trust form, subject to certain conditions. And it seems that the main bone of contention is whether the obligation of the trustee is contract-based or property-based. The result may be some compromise that would leave the contract basis, but would in fact allow property rights to beneficiaries. But for our purpose, it's important simply to understand the difference. If we view the whole area of business and financial laws, we may discover that many laws are designed to support personal trusting and institutional systemic trusting. If financial and technical climates have changed, the same principle may suggest that we should amend the rules to achieve the same result, the same purpose. We may look for alternatives and for technical mechanisms, and we'll probably discover that they are at work on the internet. The purpose would remain the same. Legal models will affect as well as be affected by the culture, and therefore we must be careful to evaluate the impact of these models on trusting before we change or discard them. The last point that I made now highlights the discussion series. Those who are in the business of trusting services should be supported by law, regardless of how they are formally organized. If an institution is in the business of offering trusting relationships, then the rules that protect trust should apply. Corporations that sell shoes and corporations that sell fiduciary services are both corporations. But fiduciary law does not apply to the shoe sellers, it does apply to the money managers. It is the business, not the legal form, that determines whether public trust is involved and how important the business is to the financial system. And similarly, law firms may be organized in different forms for tax or other purposes, but the fiduciary duties of the firms and their lawyers are not affected by those forms. So here is our food for thought for this session. And it comes close to the internet now. Question is a seller of goods that collects and sells information about the buyer's purchase patterns, is he a fiduciary with respect to that information? I'm very much looking forward to your comments. Thank you.